Right now, 28 Kenosha, 27 Racine. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
And we welcome you to the Friday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. Today we're going to be exploring the splendid, inspiring story of the Tiger Bells. They were the women's track and field team of Tennessee State University, and they rose to greatness during the 1950s, and their rise culminated in spectacular fashion at the 1960 Olympic Games in Rome, where they dominated the proceedings in amazing fashion, led by the great Wilma Rudolph. The story of the Tiger Bells is told in a really interesting new book called The Tiger Bells, Olympic Legends from Tennessee State. The book is by Amy Alley Card, a nonfiction editor for Panegyrus Literary Magazine, a board member for the Women's National Book Association Boston chapter, and the author of a previous book called And Beneath It All Was Love, My Path Home Again Through Breast Cancer. This book called The Tiger Bells is published by Lions Press. I began my interview with Amy Alley Card by asking how a Boston-based nonfiction writer would come to know about the story of the Tiger Bells of Tennessee State University.
So even though I live in Boston now, I grew up in Nashville, Tennessee, which is where the Tiger Bells are from. That's where Tennessee State is. And my grandfather was a track coach at Vanderbilt at the time. And so I grew up knowing about the Tiger Bells. I grew up knowing them as the highest form of athletic achievement in my mind. And as I, you know, grew up, moved to other places, lived in different places in the world, I was always surprised when other people hadn't heard of the Tiger Bells. They were, to me, just this, you know, high standard of achievement. And the more I was curious about the story, this is what I do, I dig into things and I'm curious about them, the more I realized that everyone really needs to know who they are. And it just seems like people everywhere in the world can be inspired by what they accomplished.
Absolutely. And I'm so glad that this story is finally being told, and told so thoroughly and in such exciting fashion. So when did you undertake this, and where did your odyssey begin in terms of learning still more about the Tiger Bells and learning enough about this story in order to be able to tell it in the way that you do?
So it's been a while. My daughter, who's now 21 years old, when she was 11, she had a school project and she was not connecting with it was supposed to be about an autobiography. She picked up something in the library. She wasn't connecting with it. And I had Coach Temple's autobiography. He is the coach. Ed Temple was the coach of the Tiger Bells. And I said, hey, how about this one? This is one I read and I think it's, you know, pretty awesome, this group of women runners. And she read it and she loved it. And I was thinking, wow, this 11-year-old girl reading an autobiography from an 80-year-old man about something that happened, you know, decades before. And she was just so enthralled. She did a great project. It ended up getting featured in her class and everybody else loved it. And I thought, everyone is missing the story it's kind of like the greatest sports story that's never been told. And so, you know, that's kind of what my daughter really, her interest was really what clued me into thinking even young girls, even people that aren't necessarily interested in history or sports are going to love this story too. So
where did you go or to what resources did you turn in order to learn still more about the Tiger Bells, and what ended up being most valuable to you in that endeavor?
Well, I was lucky because, as I said, my grandfather was a coach at Vanderbilt at the time. And while he passed away before I was born, we've been long since a part of the Vanderbilt community. And he, my grandfather, was, before he passed away, pretty good friends with Coach Temple. And people in the community, they kind of know each other. One of our family friends was a really big supporter of the Tiger Bells and close with Coach Temple. And I just reached out to him and I said, would he have any interest in talking to somebody about the Tiger Bells? And so I was able to interview pretty quickly into the project. I was able to interview Coach Temple. And that really cemented in me that just being able to talk to him, and he's just an incredible person with so many great stories about what they accomplished, and, you know, a real truth teller about everything that they had to overcome. And that really cemented the process pretty early on. I mean, I was lucky being a Nashvillean growing up to have those personal connections.
We're speaking with Amy Alley Card about her new book, The Tiger Bells, Olympic Legends from Tennessee State. It is the story of the rise to greatness of the women's track and field team at Tennessee State University, and a rise which, in a sense, climaxed with the spectacular performance by these gifted women at the 1960 Olympic Games. I really appreciate how early in the book you take some time to describe Tennessee State University and where it was in the city of Nashville, and how it was, in your words at one point, a little utopia, a town within a town. And it's part of the story that I don't think should be neglected or brushed past too quickly. Tell our listeners more about TSU itself at this particular time in the late 1940s, as your book essentially begins, and what it meant to the blacks of Nashville, Tennessee at that time.
They had their own space. And I mean, obviously segregation was a terrible, terrible thing, but they did have their own community where they felt safe at that time. And that was described to me by Howard Gentry Jr., who grew up on Tennessee State's campus, as this place. He never, as a young child, he wasn't faced with a lot of issues on this campus setting where he had everything he needed, and it was just a little bubble. But as he grew up, and as the grown-ups all knew, this was just a little bubble inside a world that was full of danger for them. But so it was kind of a juxtaposition of, you could be a student and have a great experience with your world and this little, just on campus and out, just outside the campus, little micro city. But then just outside it, it was, you know, fraught with peril.
You tell us that the president of the school at the time, one Walter S. Davis, really believed in supporting athletics, even if that doesn't necessarily extend all the way to women's track and field the way one might hope. And of course, as your book begins, there isn't actually any such thing. There isn't yet a women's track and field team at TSU. But explain why President Davis felt like athletics needed to be an important part of TSU and its legacy. What kind of difference did he think it could ultimately make?
Well, I mean, athletics always has been a way for schools to gain interest, get people onto campus to support their teams. And he saw that, and he saw the potential in his student body to really excel in this area in a quick way, to get the attention. There were many areas that they excelled in, but athletics is just something that people are interested in the wider world. And so it could really attract attention and funding to the school. and get the wider community support behind all the students.
So explain to our listeners how Ed Temple first became associated with Tennessee State University.
So he was recruited to run track. He was a track runner himself, and he was running up in Pennsylvania, and the coach at the time, at the TSU men's coach for track and field, had recruited him, and also Leroy Craig, who was his rival in his town. And the way he convinced each of them to come to Tennessee State was by telling them that the other was going. And so they thought, Ed Temple thought, if Leroy Craig is going to be there, then it must be a great program. And then at the same time, he told Leroy Craig that Ed Temple was going. And so they both ended up going and realizing that they kind of got told, you know, they were kind of pushed into the situation, but once they were there, they had a great experience, and they really dug into it. But the way that Ed Temple got to be a coach was he was looking for a job after school, a coaching job, and he had already graduated. He was staying in the dorm, and he got called into the head of school's office, and he thought he was about to get kicked out of the dorm because he was overstaying graduation. But instead, he got offered a job to coach the women's track team. And, you know, it wasn't something he'd been looking for before, but he was happy to have a job. And then once he got into it, he never did anything else for his entire career.
I do want you to take a second to describe his reaction when he first arrived at TSU as a student, because if I remember correctly, when he got there, I mean, TSU had barely even begun its track program. And if I remember correctly, at that point in time, it really didn't even have a track, which is about as basic a necessity as one needs to have a viable track team.
That's right. They didn't really have a track at all. Tim Harris, the coach, was they were basically just running in a field at that time, and they were doing some construction at the school, and so he got one of the trucks carrying gravel just to kind of dump some gravel, and they spread the gravel around to kind of makeshift their own track. And Coach Temple, coming from a pretty good track program, a pretty good school, he couldn't believe it. He was saying, you know, what is this? What did I do? What am I here for? But it took a really long time to get a proper track. They didn't have a proper track until deep into the 70s. So even as he built his own program with the women's track, they still were working on a track that just went halfway around, still kind of working on the basics that Tim Harris had put into place. So yeah, it was a long time process just to get them the facilities that they needed.
Wow.
I mean, it's the same with Tennessee State as with a lot of schools. Football and basketball are their big sports. They put a lot of seats in the stands, and track is it's usually a smaller program, and it's kind of low on the list of budget items. So something they really struggled with.
Right. I mean, that's one of a number of challenges which this team, which its athletes faced over the years, and it makes what they ultimately managed to achieve all the more impressive. So tell us more about the challenge that Coach Ed Temple faced in terms of starting up a women's track and field team, essentially from scratch.
Well, the first thing is he had a budget of about $64 for everything, and that was all the gear that they would need for the whole year. That was all the travel that they would need to do. So with that kind of budget, you really can't travel. You can't take a team out of state. But they made it down to the Tuskegee relays, and they just got trounced, and he did not like that feeling of not winning. And so he really dug in and was thinking, you know, how do I build this program? How do I make it into something? And what he did was he recruited Mae Faggs, who was at that point the most promising track and field athlete. female track and field athlete in the whole nation. She had gone to the 1948 Olympics, and by the time he reached her, he built a small program, still growing. You know, he had a couple of strong athletes that had made it to the Olympics, but individually, it wasn't a collective program yet. And when he recruited May Fags, he kind of pulled the same thing that his coach had. He convinced her to come to Tennessee State, told her he was going to give her everything she needed. And, you know, when she got there, she realized that, oof, there's no track, there's no budget. People aren't really supporting the track program, but they work together. He convinced her, and I really think it was his dedication. He thinks that she chose Tennessee State over Tuskegee, which was really the stronger program at the time, because it was closer to home for her. She was from Bayside, New York, and I really think that he had a lot to do with it, because he was just so dedicated to the team. He was just going to do whatever it took to give them what they needed in order to succeed, no matter what little resources they had.
I'm excited for us to talk for a few minutes about May Fags. That's a name I did not know at all, and it's one of those names that should be better known than it is, and I'm thankful that she is as prominent in your book as she is. And she, of course, ends up really making a huge difference in the rise of this program, even if she is not still competing by the time those dramatic 1960 Olympic Games are run in Rome. One of the things you mention about her, and I think you just mentioned it as well, is that she essentially came from the North, lived in the North, came down south to Nashville in order to study and compete at TSU, and you describe it as an incredibly shocking experience for her, and that's probably an important thing for us to acknowledge. So describe to our listeners the kind of jarring, disconcerting shock it would be for somebody like a May Fags to be living in a place like Nashville, Tennessee in the early to mid 1950s.
So there were specific examples of things that she would have to deal with. For example, if she wanted to go see a movie downtown, she had to, you know, everyone, it was a segregated issue, and so she and her friends would have to go down the back alley and climb up basically the fire escape stairs and sit up in the balcony. There would be, you know, lots of restaurants that she wouldn't be able to go to. When she would go downtown to shop, it was, you know, just a different kind of experience than she was used to having. It was just right in the middle of the Jim Crow South and the rules that were in place in the town at the time. And on top of that, she dealt with not having the funding, and that is specific to, you know, the women's track program. She had been the national champion in her particular events for the past few years at that point, and she didn't have the money to go back to the national championship to defend her title. So she broke her record just because she didn't have the money to get her to the meet. And so it was both of those things in concert that were really tough on her. And Coach Semple really worked with her to let her know that what they were doing there was going to be, they were building something. You know, there were challenges she was going to go through, but what they were building was really important. And she stayed, and what they did ultimately did end up building a program that many argue is responsible for Title IX. So not even just in her community, but for all of women who wanted to participate in sports, what the Tiger Bells were able to achieve. And Coach Temple would be the first to tell you that wouldn't have happened without May Fags, without her being such a strong athlete and a draw for other women to come into the program, and how dedicated that she was to making the program succeed and to bringing up the younger people behind her. Without May Fags, the Tiger Bells would not have happened. Hmm.
I know that you quote at least one of the illustrious athletes who came along a bit later is saying that essentially May Fags was almost like a second coach. I mean, beyond what you just said in terms of she herself being a great athlete and also being a great athlete that others wanted to sort of be around and compete with. But she was also somebody who seems to have been a real natural when it came to working with her teammates and doing whatever it took to, in a sense, elevate everybody's excellence. And, of course, not all star athletes know the first thing about doing that.
Right. There were things that Coach Temple, you know, he had run track, but, you know, he had never coached women before. There were things, you know, slight differences in the way that certain things would be, you know, technical aspects of their skills, but also big things like running on the indoor track. Coach Temple had not done that, where he didn't really understand about, I don't know if your listeners have seen bank tracks, which is the indoor tracks usually have a little ramp along the edges of them. And that's a different kind of running that you do than on a flat outdoor track. And you have to learn how to, your instinct may be to slow down as you go around the bank, but really you're supposed to use the bank to kind of push off up. And May Fags knew that. And she was teaching Ed Temple that, you know, how to run on a bank track. And then she taught the whole team how to do it. And that was that kind of generosity, that kind of not competing with her team, but considering them all together. We're all going to do this together, and we're going to help each other out. We're going to help each other achieve. That was the beginning of and Barbara Jones, who came later, would say that was the beginning of the concept of a team. Where before, track and field was an individual sport, it was a collective sport, but each individual athlete competed in their own event, aside from the relays. But that really became a team, how they helped each other in every little aspect and made each other stronger. Hmm.
So the rise is quite rapid in that the women's track and field team from Tennessee State wins a national championship, do I remember, in 1955?
That's right.
And one term that is easy to sort of brush past and not properly appreciate is that was TSU's first integrated national championship. I mean, that term will make sense if people just kind of stop and think about it, but explain why that is so truly significant.
Well, it was the only sport at that time that was integrated, and so they had the opportunity to show that they weren't just better in, you know, their community, they were better against everyone. They were the national champions, and no one could say that they were less than anyone else. And I think a lot of people think of, you know, the 1957 basketball team is the first to do that, but the women actually did it first. You know, if you're looking back at the basketball national champions, that did happen in 1957, but the women did it first, and I think they deserve the credit for it, even though it was only track.
Right. Only track. I mean, that's actually an important point, because one of the parts of your book that's maybe the hardest to believe is kind of the lack of excitement that seemed to surround this. I mean, once they got back home to Nashville and back home to TSU, one would think that an accomplishment like this would have been trumpeted to the heavens, but somehow even an accomplishment as amazing as that was not sufficient to generate the kind of excitement and appreciation that was warranted. Was that more of this baseball football supremacy thing that was keeping this off to the side?
I think so. And I think also just the idea of women in sports, what people didn't really know what to do with that. Women weren't encouraged to participate in athletics at the time. And so just the idea about women being in sports and doing something better than the men's team were able to do, it made everybody a little bit uncomfortable, I think. I think it was just something that they didn't really know what to do with, and they also didn't recognize what the achievement was because they just weren't paying it that close of attention.
For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Amy Ali Card about her new book called The Tiger Bells, Olympic Legends from Tennessee State. The book tells the story of the rapid rise in greatness of the women's track and field team at Tennessee State University, a rise which ultimately climaxed in a spectacular performance at the 1960 Olympic Games. What we were just talking about in terms of this first national championship and integrated national championship for TSU, it's right around the time that this nickname, the Tiger Bells, was coined for the women's track and field team. Explain to our listeners kind of how that nickname is put together.
So it came from the PR person at Tennessee State. He was thinking, so Tennessee State mascot is the Tigers. The men's team were all called the Tigers. And it came from, we're going to play around with this name. Are we going to call it Tigerettes? Are we going to call it, you know, they were thinking about something to differentiate the women's team. And Earl Clanton, he hit on Tiger Bells, and it just rang true for everyone. It just, it was because ringing a bell, but also a Southern bell. So it's actually spelled B-E-L-L-E-S as a Southern bell. So it was something they were really proud of with the team, that they wanted to be considered ladies. This was something that they, because women's athletics were not encouraged at the time, they took great pains to make sure that everyone still saw them as ladies. And so that was something that they were, you know, it's a little distasteful as we consider it. They should just be athletes and they should be recognized at the time. But when they were living and where they were living, it was very important to them to not have any other reason for people to tell them they couldn't run. And so if they wanted to be promoted as a team, they had to keep this image as being, okay, we can run, but we are also ladies. We're Southern ladies. We're Southern Belles. That was part of the name Tiger Bells. But that name over time became a symbol of something much stronger, much greater. To earn the name Tiger Bell, you had to really be at the top of your game. Mm.
You quote Coach Ed Temple at one point as having, as in a sense, kind of a mantra for these young women running on his team: look like a lady, act like a lady, and run like a man. Of course, coaching a team is about a whole lot more than mantras and slogans. Describe to our listeners the kind of coach that he was, and also beyond the matter of commitment, which you mentioned earlier, what you think were the most crucial ingredients in his tremendous success as a coach.
He was tough. This is one of the first things that when I was researching, even before I was able to talk to him, was just how tough he was. The practices were so hard. Every summer they would do a boot camp that was 2 weeks long, where all the runners, and you think about track runners as mostly sprinters, less distance, they had to run miles and miles. They ran about 18 miles a day, every day, for 2 weeks in the Tennessee heat. Three different sessions throughout the day, but about a total of about 18 miles. And that's marathon level running. That's not what you consider sprinting, but he had the idea that you needed the same legs and lungs to do distance running as you needed sprinting. And that was just the way that you develop yourself as a runner. And then after those 2 weeks of tough running, then they would spend detailed time on technique. And so his philosophy was, it was tough. It was no nonsense. You really work on the fundamentals. You really work on what it takes to get there. So my question when I got started researching is, he was so tough. Why do all the Tiger Bells love him so much? You know, years later, at the end of their life, they look back at him. They just, you can tell they just adored him. And so that was my question when I was able to, the first person I talked to was Chandra Cheeseborough, who's now the current coach of the Tiger Bells, the Tennessee State track team. And she was a Tiger Bell later on. And she said it was because he was like a father to us. So you have this toughness, you have these expectations, but you also have the support for them as people and the love that you have, you know, bringing them into the family, looking out for them. When he brought everybody onto the team, he made a big point of getting to know their parents and sitting them down and letting them know what the expectations were of being on the team, but then what they could also achieve. You know, most of the women on the team, it was their first time to go to college. And they were the first people, I mean, in their families to be able to go to college. So this was a life-changing opportunity for them to get the education. And so it was the total concern and the total care of his team, I think, that really made the difference, that made them work for him in the way that he expected them to. And that really achieved the total package that you needed to be a great athlete. You need the heart as well as the physical capabilities.
A little later in the book, there's a really nice quote that says, Coach Temple was tough, but also fair and kind. And that does seem like a nice combination of factors, of characteristics that really could lead to someone being especially great. Well, I don't think we should wait any longer. We should talk about this extraordinary athlete named Wilma Rudolph. But I do want to hasten to add that one of the things that I think distinguishes your book is the fact that this is not the Wilma Rudolph show. I mean, you really tell the story of an array of compelling athletes who are all part of this story. But, of course, the name, the individual name that is remembered above all others is Wilma Rudolph. Explain the interesting circumstances under which Coach Temple first saw Wilma Rudolph in action.
So because, you know, we've talked about the low budget that they had, Coach Temple had what he called a side hustle, where he would go and referee for the high school basketball games just to earn some extra cash. And I think he also used it as an opportunity to scout potential plate runners for his team. And he went to Clarksville. He spotted Wilma Rudolph, who was, she was young at the time. He had his eye on her for a few years. He gave her some pointers, but he spotted this natural talent. She was fast on the team, and as she grew, she got to the point where she was just dominating the track team, putting up, you know, 40 points a game. And he had his eye on her. And the other thing that he had gotten to know, and that most people, the other thing about Wilma Rudolph that most people will know, is that she had suffered polio as a child, you know, lots of diseases. She was born premature, and she really suffered with her health when she was young. And until she was 9 years old, one of her legs was in a brace. And so she wasn't even walking around without help of this corrective brace on her leg. But then by the time she was in middle school, she was on the basketball team with the high school players, and she just couldn't stop running, couldn't stop playing basketball, anything, because part of it may have been because she was so held back as a child, but she also had this height, this natural talent. And she also had a really sweet personality and disposition that charmed everyone that she knew. But Coach Temple found her early, had to convince her dad to let her go practice with the Tennessee State team in the summer. So they had a program where he would work with high school runners as kind of a farm league to bring women to the college team. But so they would have to go and stay in Nashville for the whole summer. And her dad didn't want her to go, wasn't sure if it was going to be safe, but he spent a lot of time convincing her parents that he'd take good care of her, look after her like she was one of his own. And eventually she was allowed to come to Tennessee State, and the rest is history, because Wilma Rudolph is one of the greatest athletes that's ever existed.
Right. I don't remember who was describing her this way. Maybe it was Coach Temple himself, but saying beneath all the charm was an electric energy reminiscent of an unbroken filly being set free in the field. What a beautiful way to put it. Wilma Rudolph also came from extremely poor circumstances. And is she the athlete who came from an exceptionally large family as well?
That's true. She was the 20th of 22 children. So it was just a huge family. They dealt with poverty, so many children, and she, it was a real challenge for her to have what she needed. Her mom, in order to have to work with all her health issues with so many children that she had to care for, her mom still dedicated one day every week to take her on the bus from Clarksville to Nashville to go to Meharry Medical Center to get her leg treated. And all that dedication, they really worked with her. You know, they cared so much about her as a child. And so she had the support of her parents, absolutely.
Another really noteworthy athlete whose name I absolutely did not know at all, and I mean, I know something of Olympic history, but I'm kind of shocked at my own ignorance that I did not know the name of, and I'm not even sure how to pronounce it, Willie B. White, the long jumper. Willie. Just Willie B. Willie. White. Another amazing story, and I'm so glad that that is part of this book. Tell our listeners who she was and what made her, I should think, an especially fascinating person to write about.
Oh, I loved getting to know Willie White. She was, you know, I say they're all kind of my favorites because they all have fun aspects about her, but I really have a soft spot for the rebel. she was the rebel on the team. She had a hot temper. She was scrappy, but she had to be because she came from really another challenging upbringing that she had. She and Wilma Rudolph were both 16 when they came to Tennessee State to run in the junior program, but everybody considered Wilma young and they wanted to look out for her. But Willie, nobody felt like they had to take care of Willie because she was so scrappy. She was used to taking care of herself, and she was so fast. It's kind of a funny story. Ralph Boston, who ran with the team, he was on the men's team for Tennessee State, and he won several medals of his own. But he was friends with Morgan Freeman, the actor, who grew up in Greenwood, Mississippi, which is where Willie White grew up. And Ralph Boston asked Morgan Freeman if he had run track in high school, and he said, "No way would I run track in high school because I didn't want to lose to a girl," because he was going to lose to Willie White. She was the fastest runner in the whole area. And but when she got to Tennessee State, she, like I said, she had a really challenging upbringing. She was raised by her grandparents, and she lived in Greenwood, actually Money, Mississippi, which was the town where Emmett Till was murdered. And she lived there at the time. And she, like a lot of the other children, worked in the cotton fields to earn money in the summer. And she hated that. Emmett Till murder, the trial was happening for the prior year to 1956 when she came to Tennessee State for the first time. And so it was very present in her mind and in the town where she lived. And So when she got the opportunity to go to Tennessee State, she took it without even questioning. And then when she got there in the summer, they were talking about the Melbourne Olympics that was going to be happening. And, you know, she was just in high school. Everybody was telling her, no way, you're not going to make it. You're just a high school athlete. And she said, there's this thing called, she had never heard of the Olympics before, but as soon as she learned that that was going to happen and it was going to take place and give her the opportunity to be away from home for the entire cotton season. And so by the time she had to go back home, the work would be done. She said that was her motivation to make the team. And she figured that the long jump was the sport that she had the least competition in. And so she taught herself how to jump. And even though everyone was telling her, even on the team, they thought she was too young, she was untested, she wasn't going to make it, but she just jumped and jumped. She found out how far she was going to have to jump. She jumped and jumped, and then that year she won the national championship. Well, she got second to her teammate, Margaret Matthews. She won the junior championship, and then she made the team. She goes to the Olympics in Melbourne, and she earns a silver medal. She got second in the world when she was 16 years old. Hmm. And at the beginning of that year, she had never heard of the Olympics. She was just determined to go.
Well, and you say something about how that was her first long jump competition outside of the state of Mississippi. And it's at the Olympic Games in Melbourne, Australia. I mean, absolutely incredible. You also tell us, in addition to more about those Melbourne Olympics, that were not nearly the glorious success of the 1960 Olympics, but they still managed a couple of bronzes and so on, and this silver medal from this youngster. But you say that when these athletes were in Melbourne, it gave many of them a taste of an unsegregated world, and how amazing that must have been for them.
There's this photo of Willie White hugging the person who won the gold medal. She was from Poland, and they were just cheek to cheek and just so happy. It's one of the photos that I just love. She did not realize that there was a world where she could be friends with white people. They were always the enemy, not enemy, but they were always, she never was comfortable in that world until she got to Melbourne. And she was able to see people can sit next to each other and eat, and they can live, and you know, they can share rooms together, they can dance together. And this opened up a whole new world of opportunity where she realized that it wasn't that, you know, white people or black people were the problem. It was the world that she was living in. And so it did. It gave her an education, everybody on the team, an education of what was possible in the world and what they could expect something different.
As we proceed through the 1950s, we see more and more amazing athletes come to TSU, and this extraordinary team is slowly taking shape. Athletes like Isabel Daniels and young Barbara Jones and Lucinda Williams and so on. One of the names that I did know before reading your book, interestingly enough, was a woman by the name of Earlene Brown. And the reason I knew that name is because long, long, long time ago, I was a huge fan of roller derby. I would watch roller derby every Saturday when it was on television. And I remember this this big black woman who wore number 747 for the Los Angeles Bombers, and her name was Earlene Brown. And only many, many, many years later did I learn that she won the bronze medal in the shot put at these dramatic 1960 Olympic Games. And she is also part of the legacy of the Tiger Bells. And it was really Coach Temple, you tell us, who, in a sense, got her in shape in order to compete at this really high level.
That's true. She wasn't a Tiger Bell. She lived in California. But once they got to the national team and Coach Temple, he earned his right to coach the national team for the first time in 1958 when they took the delegation to Russia. But once he really tried to train her, but she was funny. She was she was saying, I don't want to run. I'm a shot putter. He'll make me go a couple times around the track, but that's it. She had a lot of attitude that she deserved, because as you said, she was fantastic and had a long career after in roller derby. But she was just a great friend on the team to all the Tiger Bells. She loved the Tiger Bells. She took them under her wings. She had more international experience than most of them did at the time, and more just national experience too. And she hadn't experienced the same, because she lived in California, it was a different, her experience with the Black women was different from theirs in the South. And so she really was brought into the team under Coach Temple's coaching, but also as a kind of a leader to them too, as a kind of an example of someone that they could follow. But she was also a little bit of that trouble with the dancing, where they would get in trouble for dancing when they were supposed to be resting up for their meet. And she liked to have her fun, and she was always out on the dance floor.
Well, your book, of course, in a sense, climaxes, culminates with this extraordinary success achieved at the 1960 Olympics. And actually, you give us a little foretaste of it at the very beginning of the book. And ultimately, of course, we read of what an amazing performance the Tiger Bells turn in at those Olympics, including Wilma Rudolph winning two individual golds, plus leading the 4x100 relay team. And we leave it to our listeners to read that whole account in its entirety. In a sense, and Coach Temple went so far as to say this, their achievement almost came too early, in a sense. Explain the way in which this victory was almost too soon to be properly taken in.
It's true. I mean, still by 1960, women were not expected to be athletes. They didn't have the programs that they needed to have. They didn't have the support that they needed to have. So they were world famous after their performance at the 1960 Olympics. Nobody expected them to do what they accomplished. But in the United States, people didn't really know what to do with them. But if they had achieved now what they achieved then, which has never been done, I mean, seven people from one school on this team and as a school just dominating the Olympics, if they had achieved that, they'd be sponsored by Nike, Adidas, you know, they'd have all kinds of Gatorade, they'd have all kinds, they would be world famous. They would, you know, be rivaling Tiger Woods, that kind of level of fame. And that just isn't something that existed for women at the time. And they still were amateur athletes. They got a fair amount, especially Wilma Rudolph. Like you said, she got a lot of attention. She got to go meet the president, you know, but one thing that it always sticks with me is that she was on this game show. The winners got $500 for participating in this game show, but her $500, which she sorely needed, was donated to the AAU because she was an amateur athlete. And so even though she had to go to New York and participate in this game show, she wasn't allowed to keep any of the financial benefit from it. So, that's what he meant by they came too early. They didn't get the attention and the accolades that they really deserved at the time.
Well, your book helps to rectify that. The book, again, is The Tiger Bells, Olympic Legends from Tennessee State. These amazing athletes who did so spectacularly well at the 1960 Olympic Games in Rome. You can read all about it in this marvelous book published by Lions Press and the author, Amy Alicard. Amy Alicard, it was great to talk with you about this terrific story and your wonderful book. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me and talking about the Tiger Bells. I really appreciate it.
All right. Good. I feel great about that. I hope you do too.
Great. Thank you. Yes, absolutely.
I think it made sense to not talk a lot about Rome because if people do know anything about this, that's what they know about. And so I want to be sure that people understand that there's all this other stuff that makes the story fascinating. So
yeah, and then when you get to Rome, you understand like what it really fully means.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So all right, well, this was a great pleasure. So And I enjoyed seeing your pretty dog in the background, too.
She does that for everything. She just hangs out. It's really nice that she's learned how to be quiet.
Yeah, that was good, too. Mine are not so quiet, but anyway. I thought you would enjoy that little exchange towards the end of our interview with her beautiful dog in the background as we finished up our conversation. The book, again, is called The Tiger Bells. Tomorrow on the Morning Show podcast, we are going into the archives and replaying a couple of favorite interviews with Nan Calvert. And Nan Calvert has stepped down after 18 years of contributing monthly programs around environmental issues. And this weekend, two of Nan's favorites, one program, a discussion of lichens, and the other, a discussion about one of the most amazing